Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. Today, groundbreaking research into the bugs in our bowels and some discoveries that could help us to keep healthy and well. Could a widely available and relatively cheap vaccine prevent heart attacks and strokes? And the drugs you don't want to have if you're trying to protect your memory and thinking ability? It's been known for some time that commonly used medications which have what's called an anticholinergic effect on the body could be detrimental to your thinking and memory and perhaps even speed the decline into dementia. Anticholinergic means they block or reduce the action of an important chemical messenger in the brain called acetylcholine, which is important in thinking and memory function. And there are a lot of medications which either work by blocking acetylcholine or have it as a side effect. Now a study of brain imaging appears to confirm the suspicion of harm. Shannon Rissacher is in the Department of Radiology and Imaging Sciences at Indiana University School of Medicine.
We looked at the effect of these drugs on cognition, on brain volume and brain function in a cohort of cognitively normal older adults. On average, their age was about 73.
But their thinking and memory was in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
We categorized their medications that they reported taking into those who were taking what we call medium or high activity anticholinergic drugs. So this is a list of drugs that has a significant effect on the acetylcholine system. And we divided the group into those who were taking it and those who were not taking these drugs.
Can you give us a flavor of the drugs that they were on in that group?
Well, some of the drugs are over-the-counter. There are things like diphenhydramine, which is in a lot of the sedating antihistamines that are available over-the-counter, as well as over-the-counter drugs for motion sickness. And then some of the other drugs were prescription drugs for things like COPD, chronic bronchitis, depression, vertigo, and then drugs for urinary incontinence.
Okay, so you classified them into two groups. One group was taking these medications, one group was lower on those medications. What were you looking for? What did you study?
So we studied cognition. We specifically looked at memory and we looked at executive function, which is like decision making and planning, problem solving. And we also looked at neuroimaging measures. So we had neuroimaging measures of brain volume and neuroimaging measures of brain function, which we measure by looking at the glucose metabolism in various places of the brain.
So you did MRI scans and PET scans on them?
Correct, yep. And we also looked at the probability of people progressing to dementia over time. So this was a study that had follow-up ranging from 6 months to 10 years. So we looked to see whether or not those people who were taking the high anticholinergic medications were more likely to develop dementia over the course of the study.
What did you find?
We found that patients who were taking the high anticholinergic drugs showed poorer cognition, so they had lower scores on memory and executive function. They also had lower brain volumes in both the total brain volume as well as in areas of the brain that are important for memory and cognition, like the temporal lobe. And they also showed lower brain function, lower glucose metabolism in these same regions, both globally and in the hippocampus, which is very important for memory.
Now, work done in southern France around Montpellier has found that there is a tangible decline in people with anticholinergics and maybe even a speeding of what's called cognitive impairment. Did you find a speeding to Alzheimer's diagnosis?
Yes, we did see that in our study. We saw that people who were taking these anticholinergic medications were generally 2 to 3 times more likely to develop cognitive symptoms like mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease. And in particular, if they were carriers of amyloid beta, which we can measure using PET scans, this is a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. If they carried both the amyloid beta and were on the anticholinergic medications, they were 7 times more likely than those who were not.
Did you get any sense of reversibility? The Montpellier study showed that if people came off their anticholinergics, many of them reverted to normal brain function.
We didn't look at that in this study, but that actually is the next study that I would like to do, which is to look in this cohort to see not only if they go off the medications, does the frequency of dementia go down, but also are there changes in the brain maybe the degeneration slows once they go off the anticholinergic medications.
How do you know it's cause and effect? The reason they're taking the anticholinergics, for example, for depression, the condition they're taking it for might be deteriorating their cognitive function and indeed their brain function.
Yeah, we can't totally determine that it was the effect of the drugs. Obviously, these people are taking these medications for medical reasons. What we did do was attempt to covary for the number of medications they were taking, the number of comorbid conditions that they had, and a list of whether or not they had certain comorbid conditions, things like depression, things like heart disease, things like a history of traumatic brain injury. And what we found was even when we included those variables in our model, we still saw a significant effect of taking the anticholinergic medications. We can't rule out that there is some other effect that we aren't categorizing that's actually causing this.
Are the results strong enough? Well, it seems to be from the conclusion from your study, because you've actually stated it in your paper, to really avoid these medications where possible.
I would say yes, especially if there are alternative treatments. The medications are being used for things that are important. People need to be able to sleep well. People need to treat their depression. So if these medications are what helps with that, you probably should continue on those medications. However, if there are alternatives, it might be something that one would want to talk to their primary care physician or their doctor about, maybe exploring alternative therapies if they're available.
Shannon Rissacher, thank you very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Shannon Rissacher is in the Department of Radiology and Imaging Sciences at Indiana University School of Medicine. And if you want to know about the kinds of medicines we're talking about and their rating as far as their anticholinergic effect, we'll have lists and links on the Health Report's website. And that is the program you're listening to, The Health Report, here on RN, and I'm Norman Swan. There's growing international interest into what is without question the yuckiest therapy known to medicine. Fecal transplants, yes, giving one person's poo to another to treat a variety of medical conditions. But important findings from a British-Australian collaboration could, you'll be pleased to hear, make fecal transplants a thing of the past. Sam Forster is at the Hudson Institute in Melbourne. Welcome to the Health Report, Sam.
Thank you.
What's wrong with fecal transplants? I mean, they're pretty unpleasant ideas, but it seems to make sense. Rather than doing all this research, you just bung in the feces from somebody that you know is reasonably healthy or thin or doesn't have ulcerative colitis.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've actually known about it for a very long time. In the 1950s, people were first starting to use it. But the problem really is around standardisation. We know the basic composition, but the problem is there's risks, even bacteria that are fine in a healthy individual may cause disease through opportunistic pathogens in an individual that's maybe microbiota compromised or immunocompromised.
So when you say opportunistic pathogens, you're talking about you might be down, your immune system's down, and a bug that might not affect somebody who's healthy takes advantage of that situation.
Exactly. The bacteria are designed to colonize and grow effectively, and sometimes if you don't have the proper controls in place because the immune system is compromised, they might expand too much and that would cause disease.
Such as if you're just post-antibiotics and you've got very few bugs left in your microbiome.
Exactly. So it's termed colonization resistance, where you have a strong community that's actually able to resist infection by potential pathogens such as Clostridium difficile. You could think of it like a rainforest. If you're trying to introduce a new species into the rainforest, it's a very complex community, so the likelihood of there being a space in that community that a new organism can occupy is actually quite low. If you clear cut a forest, suddenly there's lots of space and other weeds and things can access very easily.
So I interrupted you when you were going on to talk about the problems of fecal transplants, is that you may get this opportunistic infection without realizing the risk.
The problem really is the unknown unknown. So we just don't know what the risks might be. There's hundreds or thousands of species within the microbiota, and for the vast majority of them, we don't know in which conditions they're health associated or in which conditions they might cause disease.
And so your problem, Sam Forster, was that you couldn't actually grow these bugs outside the bowel and therefore study them to know what's going on.
Exactly. We just couldn't understand how to grow them in a laboratory, and if you can't grow them in the laboratory, you can't understand the functional characteristics of them, or even go anywhere further than just a correlation-type analysis.
So what was the scientific challenge here?
For many years now, we've known that bacteria live throughout our bodies. They keep us healthy. Sometimes the community is get degraded and cause disease, but fundamentally it's about keeping us healthy. And we've been able to measure them with sequencing-based technologies, so we can look at the DNA, understand the composition, but we've never actually been able to get large numbers of these bacteria and grow them in the laboratory.
Why is that?
It's just there's issues because they're very oxygen sensitive, and also they just have very specific nutritional requirements that it's difficult to maintain in a laboratory.
So they're comfortable in the bowel and you can't recreate that easily in the laboratory.
Yes, that's exactly right. And for some bacteria, they can be grown, but for the vast majority, it's a very difficult challenge.
So if you're going to develop probiotics that are true to life, if you like, it's very hard because you can't grow them up.
Yeah, so the idea is we will be able to grow them in a laboratory condition, but then actually these bacteria have to be able to move between individuals. So they produce spores, which are like bacterial seeds that are very resilient. So hopefully we'll be able to generate these spores in the laboratory and then use them to pass to another individual, just like they would in the natural environment.
So we're jumping ahead a little bit to the results of your research. What did you do in this study in terms that mere mortals would understand?
Well, basically what we've done is we've worked out a way to grow these bacteria in the lab. By growing them, it allows us to understand their biology. It allows us to sequence their genomes. It allows us to look at the genes in those genomes and start to predict what they might be doing that influences our health and the community structures within our gut.
So how have you managed to grow them when it's been so difficult?
A lot of time and a lot of hard work is the short answer. It's a case of there's been a dogma in the field for a very long time now that the gut microbiota is unculturable. And so it's just been a case of going through the process and working out all the nutritional requirements. And we just got very lucky.
So you've managed to isolate about 140 different families of bacteria from the bowel when there's about 1,000 or so or even more there. We don't really know, do we?
No, so we don't really have any idea how many species there are within the bowel. Somewhere between a few hundred and 1,000 are our best estimate. In this study, we've actually only looked at 6 individuals, though. So 137 species from 6 individuals is actually quite a good representation. Remembering that although there's a lot of species in there, the majority of them are actually at quite low levels. What we're able to select from a plate are the dominant species. And to actually get all of them, we would be picking millions of bacterial colonies, which obviously is infeasible.
So you basically took this from their poo, did you?
Yeah, so that's how the research is done. The fecal samples are isolated and then plated, and the colonies are then picked and the bacteria purified.
So you've then gone on and sequenced the genes and the DNA in these bacteria. What have you learned that we didn't know?
The major finding that we've had, other than this massive discovery of novel species, so we've got 45 novel species, 20 novel genera, and 2 novel families. What we've really been able to look at...
So basically, you've discovered bacteria that have never been known to humans before.
Exactly right. And I mean, when you think about it, it's quite incredible. You know, these species are with us every day of our lives. Even our ancestors, when we left Africa, probably there were ancestors of these bacteria travelling with them as we colonised the world. And it's only now with the technologies that we have that we're actually able to sequence them, isolate them and understand what they're doing, how they're helping us. I mean, from that perspective, it's actually amazing that we can even do it.
It's incredible. And what else have you found? So you find these novel species, have they got particular properties or that's yet to be discovered?
I mean, it's very early stages now. One of the very interesting things that we found was actually the number of these species that can form spores.
You better explain what spores are. People have got a kind of a notion of spores flying through the air from trees or plants, but what are bacterial spores?
Yeah, so these bacterial spores, they're similar to seeds from a tree, but they typically stick to surfaces and they're designed really to survive for long periods of time. So in the laboratory environment, for example, we actually store these spores in ethanol and put them in the minus 80 freezer and they're stable for years. And it's only then when you put them back into an environment where it's desirable for them to grow that they'll actually germinate and grow into normal, healthy bacteria.
And you think it's these spores that could form, you know, the pill, if you like, that could replace fecal implants?
Well, potentially. I mean, I think it's still at very early stages with the research. We might be able to develop coatings that create an anaerobic environment within the pill so that the spores are not necessary. For some diseases, it's only about a third of the bacteria that forms spores. So if we need to introduce other bacteria, the spores obviously won't necessarily be the best approach, but it is one option.
So this is remarkable. And where to next for this?
Well, so now we're at the beginning, really. We have the bacteria. So up until now, it was all about understanding correlations between disease and the bacterial occurrence. So we could say, if you have a particular disease, you're more likely to have a particular bacteria or a particular bacterial community. What we can do now is we can start to understand whether having the bacteria is causing the disease or whether it's just a result of the disease. And by doing that, we can then start to identify the key candidates. Obviously, it's still a very difficult task. There's millions of combinations just from these 130 bacteria that we've identified. But computationally, we now have the genomes, we have the sequencing data from diseased and healthy individuals, and we can start to understand the potential candidates and then test them in the laboratory.
And 25 years from now, the current probiotics on the market will look pretty primitive.
Well, it's interesting. The current probiotics, the idea is actually not to colonise a patient. So they typically are designed to induce an immune response but then be passed through and not maintain within the microbiota. For these therapeutics, you'd actually be really looking to replace the existing bacteria. So, for example, in a Clostridium difficile infection where it's usually a patient who's undergone an antibiotic treatment, destroyed a lot of their natural microbiota, what you want to do is you want to replace that natural microbiota and maintain it within the patient so that you prevent this Clostridium difficile infection.
So this is the springboard everybody's been looking for?
That's what we hope. We're still obviously very early stages, but I would envisage within the next few years we will start to see clinical trials of these rationally selected combinations of bacteria and then hopefully that move to the clinic very quickly after that.
Sam, thank you very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thank you.
Dr. Sam Forster is at the Hudson Institute of Medical Research in Melbourne and the Sanger Institute in Cambridge. One of the side effects of damaging the natural microbiome is that you can develop a fungal infection like candidiasis or one called aspergillosis, which can be life-threatening. The University of Perugia in Italy is home to one of the pioneers of modern microbiome research, Professor Lugina Romani. Professor Romani's interest was originally sparked by what she saw as a rise in serious fungal infections.
You become vulnerable to those fungi once you have your immune system compromised.
So you've got HIV, you're on cancer chemotherapy.
Exactly. Compromised by many, many, many treatments.
And you're not just talking about a mild candida infection here.
No, I'm talking about very severe fungal infections that are lethal and are the reasons why most of the hematological transplantation for patients with leukemia, etc., are not so successful because patients...
The fungus gets you in the end.
Exactly. Patient will die of aspergillosis all of a sudden.
Why did you think of the microbiome in the bowel in relation to these fungal diseases? Because do they come from the bowel?
Candida albicans, that is responsible for severe candidiasis, comes from the gut. Aspergillus is not a commensal of the respiratory tract.
And just for a moment, let me explain. When you say commensal, this is a normal bug that lives in you and quite happily and doesn't cause disease.
Exactly. You are candida albicans, meaning that you are made of those bugs and therefore those bugs are you. What is causing those bugs to become lethal disease in those patients? And one thing that we were interested in was the fact that the same susceptibility to those fungal infections also occur as a consequence of antibiotic therapy, meaning that there was something that you were destroying in your body with antibiotics.
Which allowed the fungus to take hold, like candida.
Exactly.
Luigi Romani was one of the first to conclude that we humans are two beings in one. A mammal with a mammalian immune system and a huge vat of microorganisms, a bucket of bugs. In fact, when it comes to DNA, we're much more bacterial than human. And life, health and disease is often a balance between the two. Like Sam Forster's group, Professor Romani's lab has analysed the bacterial DNA as well as trying to culture gut microbes in the lab. And they've had some success when it comes to a family called Lactobacilli. It turns out that you can change the way a lactobacillus behaves by changing the way you eat.
We have a particular bacteria, Lactobacillus reuteri, was able upon a proper alimentation, and I'm telling you in a minute the role of the diet, to change its metabolism, switching from eating carbohydrate to eating amino acids.
So you're talking about the diet of the lactobacillus
exactly.
here, not the diet of the human being.
Not the diet of the lactobacillus, but it is your diet, because if you
That's
are
where eating, it comes from.
Exactly, because if you are eating chocolate that is rich in one amino acid, that is tryptophan, upon which lactobacillus reuteri is very able to switch its metabolisms.
I'm hearing good news here, am
I? Yes, of course you are. Upon eating the chocolate or any food rich in tryptophan, you are selecting for lactobacillus reuteri that is able to grow and to eat tryptophan much more than any other bacteria. And this lactobacillus reuteri, upon feeding himself or itself on tryptophan, is able to produce a particular metabolite. This particular metabolite produced only by lactobacillus reuteri. Only when you have a diet rich in protein and not in carbohydrate, this metabolite is able to properly control Candida albicans in your gut. This metabolite was able to control both the fungus and the immune system of the human beings. The two natures of you, both the microbial nature and the mammalian nature.
And they've also got evidence that in addition to offering protection against Candida infections, this chemical byproduct from the lactobacillus may also, at least in mice so far, help to inhibit the immune system in so-called autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis and insulin-dependent diabetes. And before you get too excited, we're not actually saying that chocolate is the cure for fungal infections or MS, but, you know, watch this space. Luigi Romani's team has patented the substance in the hope that it could be the basis of a novel medication, which is safer than giving a probiotic to an immune-compromised person. Luigi Romani is Professor of Pathology at the University of Perugia. A novel trial has commenced in Australia which is testing the proposition that the pneumococcal vaccine might help to prevent atherosclerosis and therefore heart attacks and strokes. In fact, you may have already received a letter about it from Medicare. One of the study leaders is John Attia, who's Professor of Medicine and Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Newcastle. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you very much.
So, John, what's the observation that makes you think a vaccine could work here?
This is based on about 20 years worth of animal models in atherosclerosis, which is the buildup of fat in the arteries, which indicated that the pneumococcal vaccine, when given to mice, seemed to protect them against progression of atherosclerosis.
So this is like an accidental finding?
It is. It looks like there's something in the cell wall of the pneumococcal bacteria that looks like the bad cholesterol that builds up in the arteries. And so when you vaccinate the mice, the antibodies that you generate cross-react and seem to eat away at the plaque.
So what happens in mice does not necessarily happen in humans. What's
That's
the
right.
human evidence that that works?
That's right. So at this point, there's 6 or 7 studies that have looked at what happens in humans in the 2 to 4 years after they get the pneumococcal vaccine. And it looks as if there is indeed a reduction, perhaps around 25%, in the number of heart attacks and strokes. But the problem is selection bias. The criticism is whether people who get the vaccine are more plugged into their GPs, more interested in their health, have better lifestyle habits. And so the only way to really
Or the opposite, because Aboriginal communities get pneumococcal vaccine a lot, and it tends to be younger people or people who've had their spleen out for various reasons. So it's not necessarily good evidence because they tend to be younger or indeed sicker.
That's exactly right. So potentially the effect of this vaccine could be even greater than what we're seeing.
So let me get this right. So what you're saying is that if from the mouse model, part of the pneumococcal vaccine looks like the bad form of cholesterol.
Not so much. There's a fat in the pneumococcal cell wall that looks like oxidized LDL, and that's the form of cholesterol we find deposited in the plaque already. And the thought is that the antibodies that are generated by the vaccine bind to the plaque and actually help clear it, to chew away at the plaque.
But you don't need to be infected by the pneumococcus for that to happen.
No. This is not so much suggesting that pneumococcal is the infective agent triggering heart disease. It's, in fact, the opposite in the sense that people who get a pneumococcal infection clinically appear to develop these protective antibodies.
So if you had pneumococcal pneumonia, you seem to get less heart disease.
Yes, that's right.
So what's the trial you're going to do?
We're hoping to recruit 6,000 patients, so that's 1,000 at each of the participating centres across Australia, which are Newcastle, Gosford, Canberra, Melbourne, Perth and Adelaide. And basically randomising people have to get the placebo vaccine and have to get the active vaccine. We're hoping the people will give us permission to link with their hospital records. And to put it simply, we'll just count the number of heart attacks and strokes in the 5 years following the vaccine.
And these have got to be people who are at some risk of heart disease rather than just the general public.
That's right. So we're looking for people between the ages of 55 and 60 who have 2 out of 3 risk factors for heart disease, either high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or overweight.
And you're relying on them to tell you that?
Yes. So we're recruiting through Medicare. So,
which is one of the reasons why we're doing this story. Health Report listeners might actually get a letter in the mail because you're going to send out thousands of letters.
That's right. So 5,000 letters have just gone out 2 weeks ago to 5,000 people at each of those 6 centres, and we're hoping people will be generous and participate in the study with their time.
And is there any harm from the pneumococcal vaccine?
No. So in fact, the pneumococcal vaccine has been around for over 20 years, and it's well tolerated, very few adverse events. It's been tested, you know, for a long time.
Because there's more than one form of the pneumococcal vaccine.
That's right. There's both the protein vaccine and the polysaccharide vaccine. And it's the polysaccharide vaccine that seems to have this protective effect.
How long before you know any answers?
We have to wait 5 years of follow-up, and then it'll probably take another 2 years to get the health records linked. So we're probably looking at 7 years before we have an answer.
So don't rush out and get your pneumococcal vaccine just yet.
Not yet, no.
John Attiah, thanks for joining us on the Health Report.
Thank you very much.
John Attiah is Professor of Medicine and Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Newcastle. And don't miss tonight's Australian story about the amazing Danielle Tindall, a tireless advocate for young people with cancer, who's developed, this time a rare cancer, a second time, and has found a drug which appears to work, but where our system of drug subsidy isn't flexible enough to deal with.
10 years ago, I saw her recover from being an absolute skeleton to back to being a normal person again. And it's not out of the question that we can do it again this time.
I just never was scared of relapsing. I think I was too busy or too enjoying everything to worry about if my cancer came back. It's not the case now.
If we don't have our health, we don't have anything.
Here was my calling.
Danielle is someone who has fought really hard to make a difference to people like me, and to see that she's having to go through it again and fight cancer again is really devastating.
She's someone who's contributed enormously to society and to the community, and at this one point in time where she really needs us to give back, we've abandoned her. And that's got to be unacceptable in anybody's terms.
It's like putting a gun to your head and saying, your money or your life.
No one can tell.
That's Australian Story, which you can catch up with this week on iView. I'm Norman Swan. See you next time.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.